Hello, welcome to Oldham Village. Today is Monday, July 27th, 1998. In the Creekside room this morning is Karen Bloomquist. Today's session number is 98-1, and it is titled, Be Discern, Act, the Moral Challenge of This Society. Let's listen in.
Two-hat kind of life that I live right now. And this particular week, I thought it would be helpful for us to deal with some of the current aspects and understandings of approaches to ethics, and especially Christian ethics in our day. Especially as it engages the kinds of concerns that we have. But this is going to be a more general week in terms of some of how do we approach ethical issues more so than specific topics. But I'm very open to your kind of bringing up topics and we can engage and deal with them as we move through the week. Today is kind of setting a context for that, and especially a framing of what I think needs to be a kind of background understanding for us to talk about kind of the ethical issues and the particular ethical issues that we as a Christian community, need to grapple with. And that's why I entitled today's session, The Moral Challenge of This Society. Let me just say a word of what I'm wanting to evoke by that particular title. The moral challenge, I think, especially has to do with what a lot of commentators have pointed to as a kind of breakdown of community, a breakdown of sense of common values, a common purpose, a common vision. Many people have harkened back to how, 50 years ago, there was a kind of focus of what we were about and some shared values, and increasingly today, that has broken down. Larry Rasmussen, who taught here a few weeks ago, has an intriguing book that I find very helpful that some of you are maybe familiar with, Moral Fragments and Moral Community, where he and a number of critics of the contemporary scene talk about that kind of breakdown, not so much in terms of the breakdown of focusing on just individual morality, but the social fabric that gives our lives meaning and purpose, and it helps us to kind of hang together as a people and in search of what is good, right, just, and all the rest. So that's the kind of background for at least what I want to lay out a little bit today. And so today, what I'm going to do is give you some ideas from two books that I've encountered the last year that I think are helpful ways of getting at some of what's wrong, some of what that moral challenge is, in order for us to then, during the rest of the week, we'll be talking about things like, how does moral formation happen? How do we discern in community? How do we act corporately as Christian community in the face of some of these challenges? But this is kind of getting us into that kind of background discussion. The two books that I'm going to be talking about and are both in the bookstore. One is Civility by Stephen Carter. Some of you may know the name of Stephen Carter. He's in a lot of television programs, etc. these days. He's an African-American law professor at Yale who a few years ago wrote the book The Culture of Disbelief, which makes a pretty strong appeal for how ethical values need to be and especially religiously informed ethical values need to be much more at the heart of public discourse in society. Now, by that, he's very clear of not being very supportive of some of the ways in which that occurs, in terms of saying there is a sense of moral substance of who are we as a people that needs to be in the public arena. And this is he's got another book called Integrity, and then this is his recent book called Civility, Manners, Morals, and the Etiquette of Democracy. Subtitle is very interesting, and may, I see that subtitle and say, oh, book of etiquette. Well, that's not quite what I want to get into. And I want to be clear that the way he takes this is, I think, an interesting one, even though there's some connotations of those words that I, too, would have some real problems with. He talks about how civility is the sum of the many sacrifices we are called to make for the sake of living together. Now, that very definition of civility, immediately evoked for me some of what we experience when we become beholder. It's the rules of, for the sake of what's going to happen to the stuff on the other end, don't flush the toilet too many times, and all of the living simply, all of the messages and the signs and a part of community life that shape our life here at Holden. Carter really does goes on and on with lots and lots of examples of how that sense of civility in the wider society has broken down. He tends to point to the mid-60s as the beginning of this time of what he calls uncivility. But at the same time, he doesn't want to suggest that earlier eras were necessarily more civil. There may have been less crime, less drugs, less media violence, fewer out-of-wedlock births, but he's very quickly to remind us, if anything, the racism was more blatant and pervasive. Domestic abuse was more tolerated than it is today. More people were doing bad things to their lungs by smoking. There was a much higher rate of auto accidents in this country than there is now. So, in other words, it's a mixed picture. He's not trying to, idealize what things were like 30, 40 years ago. He doesn't want to get into a nostalgia. But he says, we used to have more of a shared moral vision, less of the kind of moral fragmentation. Now, I think what we're going to want to think about today a little bit is maybe argue with him. Is that in fact the case, or is it not? I remember being a part of a session about 2 months ago. It was a panel that was honoring Martin Marty upon his retirement. And one of the media commentators who was on that, and it was a number of well-known people who the media tends to draw upon when he's talking about religion and public life. And he said, why is it that the religious community has not been able to focus the kind of moral vision today that was focused in the 60s around the civil rights movement? And he says, there was a passion, not everybody agreed with it, but there was a kind of common purpose of what we were about and what we have to get beyond. And the commentator said, he says, as far as I'm concerned, just as devastating and demonic in some ways in our day is the power of the global economy and what that is doing to people throughout the world. We'll be probably touching on that a little bit this week. Next week, if some of you are around, I'm going to do a whole week on that. And he said, where is the kind of focused purpose? Because he says, that too strikes at the core of some central religious values. And yet there's not that kind of focused people really getting stirred up to say, we've got to challenge this, we've got to change this. Where is that passion? Where is that focus that we used to have as a society? That's a very haunting question for me, partly because I've been in recent years working on a social statement on economic life for the ELCA. There are supposed to be copies of it here, and they're not here yet. I have a few copies of it, though. But because I guess he was raising questions that I had not raised in quite the same way, and so I've been kind of turning them over, and I'm not sure I agree with everything that Carter says, but I think it at least helps to get the discussion on the road. Carter maintains that the breakdown of civility harms especially those who are on the bottom, those who are the least, because civility has to do with that concern for the other. And when everything is only driven on what's in it for me, those who suffer the most tend to be those who have the least material resources. He says, we have forgotten why discovering what we share matters. We have forgotten why discovering what we share matters. And without a sense of a society of civility, without that sense, generosity and trust come very hard. Because we lapse into this, each out for themselves, don't trust anyone, especially don't trust anyone in a position of authority, don't trust the government, all the bashing of government that certainly in this country has been going on a lot in the last 5 years. Don't trust anyone in business, don't trust anyone in authority in the church, a kind of bashing of lots of authority. And there's been an eclipse of civility, of what it means to see the other as neighbor. Though implicitly one can sense a deep central theological theme there that's very much at the heart of how we understand what it means to live out the Christian faith. But as Carter puts it, we no longer see each other as fellow passengers. In fact, we're not even riding on the same train, much less one that's going in the same direction toward a shared destiny. And I think one can especially contrast that with, for example, in the 40s, in a sense of common, you know, commitment around the time of World War II and the debt and some of the time that followed immediately. Now, again, we can get some critique there of, you know, was all that common destiny that positive? But without even getting into critique of that, you know, nevertheless, there was a kind of common purpose that we as people have. Civility requires that we sacrifice for strangers, not just for those we know. It creates a duty to do good for the other. It requires that our actions be morally justifiable. In other words, we need to be able to dialogue, to disagree, to argue with one another, to make a case for that. Instead, as we probably all are aware, we live in a society where if you don't like what's going on, you file a lawsuit. You know, the litigations and that's the way we deal with the other. Carter maintains that civility can only be reconstructed through better habits, not through better laws. And so immediately this touches base with the kind of practicing the faith book, the kind of theme of holding for the summer. What does it mean to live a way of life in the ordinariness of our life? that's where moral formation and that sense of concern for the other, either the grounds for it either are established there or not. And more often than not in our society, that's not happening. Civility requires resisting the domination by certain values that are really marketplace values. And so you can think of the kinds of values that, or the kind of language that is that we hear regularly in our society. Language of wanting, of winning, of taking, in contrast to language that has to do with community, with sharing, with fairness. Can some of you think of some examples of where those two very different kinds of languages are used?
I think advertising is one of the great sources of the former, you know, mm-hmm. the wanting and needing and mm-hmm. achieving and success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think within the church we also do that. I mean, we preach and teach about how it is that Christ would have us live, and yet we don't accept some of the brothers and sisters that we are put in the presence of just to accept and to share with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hear, and don't hear, is the language of servanthood. Perhaps it's never been very fashionable, but it seems to be without respect to the position of servant.
I mean, the newspaper business, I think one thing that disturbs me is an increasing tendency to refer not to cities and citizens, but to markets and consumers.
Yeah, that's a good example.
Even trying from the church to do market survey before we place new congregations will be successful. What are the demographics?
Investing in education. Investing. Are we talking about investing?
And in the medical profession, we no longer have patients, we have
clients.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I wrote a letter to Bill Knight in 19. He didn't write it back, but I got a letter back. It said, "Dear consumer."
That's your identity. That's the only identity that matters.
It was interesting to me, the entertainment industry. I don't know how long ago it evolved that the value, how well a movie was doing, or how good it was, or worth seeing, was determined by how many, what the box office was,
yeah.
the dollars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is it a winner? And that becomes a way of measuring whether it's a winner.
Mm-hmm.
Other examples. Obviously, this is familiar kind of terrain in terms mm-hmm. of what we experience in our society. There's also some technologies of uncivility that Carter names that I found somewhat interesting. I mean, first of all, that sense that the process of getting information is often separated from getting to know people. But then he points to things like the phone solicitations at mealtime. How many of you are as annoyed by that as I am? He talks about how he and his family have developed a technique of, as soon as they know somebody's trying to sell something over the phone, and they usually call it at mealtime because that's when families are home. He said, "I will immediately say, we do not in any way consider buying or giving to anyone who calls us at mealtime." And he said it's been very effective.
Just tell them, give me your name and address, I'll tell you if you're going to
Or one can think of the individualized experience of cyberspace. And even though one can say, well, yeah, some are making cases for how internet, there can be community there. But I think those of us who have kids and and realize how much our kids are into the computers all the time. My son is distraught because I did bring my laptop because I have to do some work, but I
forgot my power cord, so that was a big crisis when we got here. I didn't have my power cord. But the way in which that individualized experience of cyberspace means that we are able to choose what we want to know, rather than to a three-year-old, is something that, hey, we have to say out loud to one another as adults, you know, that how we treat others matters morally. The moral having to do with the shape and substance of our life together, particularly in the private, but certainly also in the private, particularly in the public as well as in the private arena. So generosity and trust, Carter recognizes, are grounded in basic Christian ethical understandings. And only a resurgence of what is best about religious faith will rescue or restore some kind of civility in our society. That's kind of the bottom line. In a critical way, I'm not that satisfied with how he responds to it, and I don't think the kind of ethical theological proposal in here has much, I don't find that as compelling as the way in which he, almost in a journalistic kind of way, can set forth all these examples of uncivility in our society. So I'm not sure his solutions are that persuasive, but I find somewhat interesting. Let me just lay a similar treatment on the table. I'm not going to deal with it as long as I have the Carter book. A book called Competing Gospels. Subtitle is Public Theology and Economic Theory. The author is Robert Simons, S-I-M-O-N-S. He is an Australian theologian who has studied in this country. And in his book, he describes how this rise of market ways of thinking means that people's motive for economic activity changed from producing what was needed into money transactions for the sake of individual gain. And I think one can certainly see that in terms of the obsession in our society with how much more the stock market is going to rise for a year or two, 3 days, maybe it's skipped, I'm not sure, but it's like, and that becomes the national barometer of how we are doing. The market becomes, and the market broadly defined, not just the stock market, becomes the yardstick for measuring value or for measuring what really matters. I'm delighted to be here this week with one of my mentors, Dorothea Zola. Dorothea, I remember when I was at Union, exchange versus use value kinds of distinction. You know, that some of that's rooted in Marx and some other thinkers. I mean, there's a lot of intellectual connections with some of this, but I'm trying to give you just kind of a little bit of what is laid out here. Human needs are reduced to wants, which become infinite and insatiable. Pleasure-seeking, atomistic individuals enter into market exchanges to serve their individual choices. And any choice will do. The only thing is being able to choose, devoid of moral content. In other words, moral content really doesn't matter. So therefore, if you gadget for $100 in the gross national product, that is valued, you know, it's given the same value as $100 that might be used to feed a poor family for a month. The primacy of self-interest and insatiable wants, the necessity of consumption, having to consume in order to keep the economy going, the striving for unlimited economic growth, now how high can the stock market go, and of course a willingness to use any means toward the hallowed end of higher profits, these become central doctrines in our economic system, and they spill over into the rest of life. Now, Simons is certainly not alone. I think there's a lot of critics who have made the point that what we are really dealing with in our world today, and I think especially in American society, is a situation of competing gods. One of the theologians in this country who some years ago, I think, raised that in a very provocative way is Douglas Meek's God the Economist. But the way in which that way of thinking just permeates everything, and you know, including in the church. And therefore, we make decisions as congregations at times according to some bottom line thinking. Not that economic, you know, I think that's part of good stewardship, of being concerned about where's the money going to come from. But when the church's mission gets driven primarily by bottom line thinking, then I think even in the church, we have to raise what are central questions of who is God, and questions of idolatry, and what is it that, you know, who is the God in whom we are confessing our faith, or in terms of our practically living out of our lives as individuals, as organizations, what is really driving us? It's my conviction that the God we confess and what that God is about in our world at key points clashes with the logic of how the economy operates. And I think the way the economy operates and this uncivility, you know, they're closely connected. Part of the reason I brought in this book is even though Carter mentions that the market economy is at the heart of that, I don't think he pushes that analysis as deeply as he might. The logic of the market by itself does not consider the effects of economic arrangements on human persons, relationships, and communities. I noticed last week one of the teaching staff members used a book called The Downsizing of America. It's out there on the table. I didn't incorporate it here, but I think it's another one that tries to make that point. One of the what we did in the earlier version of this economic life draft in a booklet called Give Us This Day Our Daily Bread, Sufficient, Sustainable Livelihood for All, is to raise up some of the understandings of Luther, for example, which were really rather amazing in terms of how he countered some of that way of thinking. I'm obviously in a much different time era than ours, but certainly raise up as a criteria by which economic practices should be judged, what is their effect on people, on relationships, and on communities. Emphasis on efficiency and growth can result in economic arrangements which are detrimental to human relationships. In terms of long hours, or well, you've got to move for this job, or the shock to a community when a company leaves. And although statistics regarding unemployment, income, and consumption may receive some attention, how dynamics of the economy actually affect people and their relationships, including the communities where we live and work, usually are not a part of what is factored into the economic thinking. And so when this tends to take over so much of the rest of our lives, then in relationships of marriage, family, community, and church life, rational choice prevails. And one chooses to leave those relationships if they no longer maximize oneself. interest. Most of us who are pastors, therefore, get called and think, well, yeah, we've got to think of what we're doing, so it'll really appeal to, people's self-interest and why they come to church. And I don't want to, I don't want to be unrealistic. And I realize that's a really tough kind of tension there. How do we resist that temptation? Simply play to the market. And yet at the same time be aware that, you've got to connect with people's interests and questions too. You can't totally ignore that. So that you find yourself in this kind of struggle. How to live, how to think realistically about how to fit and how to appeal, and yet at the same time not to be totally driven by that. The predominant biblical theological perspective is that what will serve the common good cannot be reduced only to private ends. We are social beings, and our interrelatedness with one another grounds our existence as individuals. What is good for the individual is continually viewed in relationship to what is good for the neighbor. That's pervasive in Scripture. And the common good cannot be simply determined by what will satisfy individual wants. The most fundamental human activity is not rational pursuit of self-interest, which is what economic ways of thinking tell us, but it is participation in community. And those interrelationships, in that give and take, in which we are attentive to the needs, to the hopes, and the dreams of others as well as ourselves. So that's just a little bit of, I think, what needs to be a kind of faith stance that we as Christians need to bring to this kind of milieu of incivility and predominance of self-interest. But let's have some discussion about that. How do you experience some of these dynamics in your lives? What are some of the critiques you might raise in this? I mean, any analysis, I think one can say, well, yeah, but there's this and that. I'm interested in hearing some of that, too. So let's get into some discussion. Thank you.
I guess that troubles me a little bit to, talk about the economic system driving us, or the media driving us. I think it's about personal choice. And I would promote that it's been an evolution of always wanting to do better, be able to be more creative and applying yourself and take agriculture. It used to be that when you came to harvest the neighborhood, all the farms got together and people had to work together to get the crop in. But as industrialization and mechanization came on, we were able to become more independent and less dependent on the neighbors, and so it's an isolation that starts that takes you away from your neighbor because you can take care of yourself and you don't need other people as you have more things that can do things for you, and it's the independence type of thing. And so I think that probably what at least occurs to me is the erosion. As you find more free time because you've been better at your mechanization, and it got turned into things of being able to deal with your wants instead of your needs, and what you do with your time. Because I don't think it started out that way, that it was people trying to drive the economic system. Not that that's not true in society in part, but I think the average person wants to just have a better life. And then when you go over the top and start to deal with your own needs, your own wants instead of your own needs.
Well, here at the end you kept using the phrase the common good, and I just kind of wanted to throw out to everybody a couple of books that I think go on where you said you felt maybe Carter stopped or was weaker, and okay, he described something, but John Cobb, the theologian, mm-hmm. Claremont, mm-hmm. and I don't know how to pronounce his name, Daly or Daly?
Daly, Herman Daly.
The economist, For the Common Good,
And the subtitle is something like Redirecting the Economy Toward Community and Sustainability and the Environment. Mm-hmm. And then Cobb's got one that's just Sustaining the Common Good. It's a Christian perspective on the economy. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Rasmussen. The Earth Community Earth Ethics book is another really good one. Mm-hmm. And David Orr from Oberlin on Earth and Mind. And I think those are hopeful books for us, you know, to take and use and act on, on this subject.
Karen, one of the things that I wondered about was when you were talking, and you were talking at the very last there about how, as pastors, we need to be aware of how people need to carry the word, why we need to work. And I wonder, as the church, especially in recent years, how we've compromised because of that. You know, how have we compromised? I hear a lot of people saying, church needs to be more responsible for what's happening in our nation today. And in a way, I tend to agree with that, but I'm wondering if there's been any, in your studies, if there's been any significant ways in which we've bought into that in order to keep people in the church. But, you know, I hear a lot of the planning council saying, well, we need more people so we can meet our budget. You know, that just irritates the achievers out. And I think, but then how often we've done that? You know, we've been part of the shopping market for people that say, well, I like them because they don't push my buttons. And I was just wondering if there was something in your study that you, because that's an interesting thing for me, how we've compromised preaching the gospel rather than business people.
Now, I think it's pervasive. And it's, you know, to say it was just one thing, but it's just catching ourselves with the language that we use. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but as I was saying before, it's not that one can just say, well, therefore that doesn't matter, and therefore we'll just, you know, we'll be this little isolated community that isn't concerned about how we connect with people, you know, with where people are at. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we can very quickly then become into, you know, well, how do we market the church?
Yeah.
And that language gets used.
Mm-hmm.
I hear what you're saying, but I don't agree is our biggest weakness. It's actually, it's like a double-edged sword. I think it's also our biggest strength. Just as our Christian forefathers in the past made many mistakes in their Christian walk, we're able to forgive them and see their strengths, and I hope that our grandchildren can see our struggle with what society gives us. But I see it as a strength because we evolve and include people in this ever-growing process where if we were Buddha or Confucianism, it's regimentated and doesn't allow for change.
We are also called to a mission to spread the gospel. Mm-hmm. And what Ogmandino was it wrote a book about St. Paul, the greatest salesman in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're about. Mm-hmm. So it's a struggle. Mm-hmm. Because we do make a lot of compromises. I was just noticing, commented to my wife about communion last night, that I really appreciated communion for a couple reasons. Number one, I used the common cup, or the individual cup, and by golly, they poured a good amount of wine. I used to get about half a thimble in a plastic disposable
cup. It was
cup.
Generous.
No, it was great. And you tasted it, and it was real wine. It wasn't Mogan David. You know, so I think we're making a lot of compromises in our church for expediency or whatever reasons, and we have to watch out for those. But at the same time, we have a central mission.
Earlier you were talking about how we need to practice civility, that it can't be legislated or it can't be laws. And that got me thinking about a conversation I had with one of my friends. He and his wife have two kids, and they live in a two-bedroom house. And so they were saying that their kids would have to share a room for as long as they lived in this house, and how that was really unusual
in now, you know. And and then it made me think about this thing that I heard about dorm rooms, that kids who aren't used to sharing dorm rooms or used to having their own individual TV or whatever have a hard time once they get to dorms and have to share space and share decision-making about TVs. And so I was thinking about the kind of everyday sort of decisions we can make about practicing civility and like welcoming the inconveniences, you know, making conscious decisions to keep things inconvenient so that we can practice those things.
One of the things about the civility book that I find interesting is people say the church has ceased being this moral teacher, instructor, force within the community, and I agree with that. I also think that one of the things that I see here on the West Coast is nobody cares what the church says.
Right.
There may be parts of the country where the church is missed for not speaking out. I'm here to tell you, in Seattle, they could care less. And so it seems to me that in some ways it is in these parts of the country where what's being talked about here could really be tested, because if in Minneapolis you say we're going to do this, you now have a community fight over is it something that you allow the church to do. Out here we at least have the opportunity to say, since no one cares, let's try it and see how it works. And that maybe the church was better when we were the minority community, when nobody cared. Because then we could speak without a sense of, well, we're risking what we have. Because we have so much, it's really dangerous now to start attacking the culture that's given you so much on the basis of your faith. And I'm wondering if the missionary synods of the church might not take seriously, rather than going to the demographic studies and the marketing studies, might rather say, what is the theology, the apologetics we should make for the faith in a non-Christian culture? To say that immediately creates defensiveness on our part, but it is our, you know, folks in Ballard tell me it is Christian, and it's not. How do we change that language would be important.
I mean, there's a lot of things that your comments have all the comments all up, but I think part of it is that, and what we're getting into later on this week, is we're dealing with very basic sense of moral formation, not just that that's responsibility of the church, that one could take for granted, but it's certainly not there. And what does that mean? And I don't think, I think there's plenty of parts of the country that are not that dissimilar from this part, even though I know statistically this is the most unchurched area in the country. But, you know, unchurched, you know, that whole language is self-interesting. But yeah, I think there's, we can talk all you want to about, you know, Christian missions in some other part of the world and in common with other faiths. Well, we've got an incredible encounter with other faiths here. And a faith that is not just other from us, but that is, that affects who we are. And that makes it a much more difficult, and you talk about an evangelism challenge, it's getting at the heart of how we ourselves live by those mandates.
I'd like to respond to this also. And you think about the, you asked us how we're compromising or something. And I'm from out here too, and I had a friend whose daughter was in high school, came home and said they were of German descent, and said, "Mom, we studied the Holocaust, and I wish to Pete that our ancestors had not been German, because how could they have been German and Christian, you know, and allowed the Holocaust to happen?" That's what she said, and you know, we all understand that's a generalization and all the exceptions to that, but the Christian church in Germany that flew the Nazi flags and everything. And I said to my friend, "Well, you know that our grandchildren and grandchildren will probably say the very same thing about us. How could our ancestors have been Americans, Christian Americans, called themselves Christian and allowed?" And I said, "Fill in the blank with, pick your topic. We are compromising like crazy and ignoring and blind to the thing that's confronting our generation, whether it is the earth issues or you name it." you know, you can find your own four or five other things. We've compromised, I think, very much and are not being the alternative society. Mm-hmm. What's the word? The alternative community that we should be.
Mm-hmm. How about some other moral challenges? You can either keep commenting on this, or if there's some other moral challenges that things that need to be on the table also for our discussion, I invite those kinds of contributions.
Well, I keep thinking of using marketing context, and one of the bromides that you use in marketing is you go, take it. And if you go back to Jesus said go, well, we were supposed to be there, and our customers told us where we're supposed to go, not us be there telling the customers what it is. You know, we have gone to their side. We have become them, not them welcoming, you know, inviting them to become us.
I think another challenge is what do we do with our expendable income and the craze for investing now in the stock market. And there's a movement of socially responsible investing that's come up. And I think it has to be looked at carefully too, because I think there are some opportunities through screen investments that are really still just letting us feel a little bit better, but still buying into the common market, the global market. But there are other opportunities too, to really say, I want to invest in the inner city of my city where I live, I want to invest in small farmers here, and there are opportunities for community economics in that way. But It's a growing movement, I think. But I still think people still, okay, my excess part that I can spare, I'll invest a little bit there, but the rest of it I'll put in the faster growing parts.
One challenge I'm making to myself is the thinking of always gotta get a bargain, always have to manage my money the cheapest way. And many, many issues I feel I have to do cost more. Taxes will go up if we make that decision. And that many of our commitments that are a Christian must, like for the environment, are going to cost more. We could feed all the hungry, at least in this country. It will cost more. We can have social workers that actually do social work, but it's going to cost more.
But in all of those, the question is, what is the cost? What is the reference?
Well, the payoff is, you know, we have to do it. But very often we say, no, we cannot afford to have smaller classroom ratios.
Discussion stopper at that point.
Yeah. And as being Canadian, my moral issue to throw out for this week, because I'm leaving today, how can you have a country that has 30 million people with no health care? That's immoral. It's a scandal. And in my country, we have Aboriginal people that are living like in South African ghettos. And that's our scandal. So it's like a Christian imperative. There's this huge conflict because the other part of me always is wanting the market. You know, that language is just permeated in everything. And I keep saying, oh, I got to challenge that. Maybe I am going to have to pay more financially to get a better common community where, you know, I can walk the streets and feel safe than that the person I'm approaching, you know, the man who I'm approaching in the walk can be a friend, you know, someone who could help me, not just attack me. Like, I don't like that feeling of my community's broken down. I don't feel safe, personally safe, you know, other than the city.
gave lots of very helpful contributions, a number of people. It occurred to me that I want to make sure before this ends, that this hour ends, that I don't want you to mishear me, and I don't think, I'm not sure this is, whether Carter would say this or not, but I'll say it instead. I don't want in any way to equate civility with, well, let's just be nice to each other. It's a civility that has a toughness that, you know, isn't afraid to brush up against the other, to disagree, and yet to somehow still say, hey, we're in this together. And so it doesn't mean a hearty, putting a nice, harmonious face, etc. I think that there can be a misreading of, well, let's be civil with one another and cover over all of the disagreement and differences. So I want to make sure that that's not, don't get me wrong, I want to propose that is where we need to go with this. There is a deeper sense of, how we really care for one another, but care for one another in the midst of those struggles, in the midst of being able to challenge our neighbors, not just a kind of general air of, oh, I can tolerate who you are and I'm not going to challenge.
I'd like to just share a conversation I had in the YMCA jacuzzi with a guy who was a member of the Christian businessman community. He's at a trucking firm that delivered product to other people. He was in need of a truck, and he read that 40 miles away there was a trucking company that was having financial difficulty and needed to disperse of some of their trucks. He went up there and saw a $40,000 truck that they were asking $20,000 for. He thought, well, that's a good deal, but if I offer him 10, and go out, so I offer him 10 and let it set. Then I went outside and prayed real hard, came back in, the guy says, yeah, we'll sell you the truck for $10,000. Where's the Christian civility?
Well, that's what I was talking about.
Well, one of the issues, I'm hearing a lot about money, but I'm not hearing a lot about some of the social issues that we're dealing with right now in the church. I think one of the biggest issues that the ELCA and any denomination is dealing with right now in the 90s is sexuality. Mm-hmm. The dealing with acceptance, is it acceptable, is it not acceptable, is it a sin? Are people born that way, is it a choice they make? That's something that people that I know as myself are dealing with on a daily basis, where as a Christian, you can't feel welcome to go and worship God. And people are, some people may be a choice, others it's not. And it's an issue that is a very touchy subject in the church right now. And I know our synod at home is struggling with that issue quite heavily.
And one of the things that Mother Cantina Anthony was doing, I can't remember the writer, but she talked about this issue too, this gentleman just mentioned, and she coined a phrase, I think, called invitation to civil conversation, where you agree to disagree and vote for each other, and it's a marvelous image. An invitation to civil conversation. In other words, you listen to me, I'll listen to you, and by the grace of God, something will come.
We'll be touching on some of that a little bit later, the discerning and community kind of session that you're doing as well.
I think one of the problems is that you talked about that sort of conversation, and I think as our society's evolved, there are fewer and fewer places where those conversations can occur.
Yes.
The institutions that we created where that kind of thing used to happen, it doesn't happen there anymore, because people are withdrawing. For instance, you have people who can afford to withdrawing into gated communities that perform all the functions government used to perform. They can levy taxes, they take care of the roads, handle security, all these things that government does in a broader community. So there's something that used to be a common interest where the people who can afford to have withdrawn and left that institution, and that opportunity for those without.
And that's happened in the church.
I think your comment about idolatry, I work occasionally as a consultant in conflicted congregations. Mm-hmm. And when the sense of who we are before God is lost, mm-hmm. and it now becomes my church,
yes.
the chances of doing anything in that conflicted setting are mm-hmm. next to none.
Mm-hmm.
If you can find or raise up that sense of whose church is it and whose people are we, then the hope for doing something in a conflicted setting is ultimately a First Commandment issue for Luther as to where we are.
Just a personal example, my husband just finished serving a church, actually eight consolidated together in Chicago, but the one he served was Our Lord's Lutheran Church. And many, many times he would say, you want this to become your church? You drop the Lord's out of it, and then it will be your church. Then it will be our church, instead of Our Lord's Lutheran Church. And that was nuts.
You want me to
got the message quickly.
I think another piece of this that I hope we can talk about sometime this week that just kind of has been a concern of mine is the whole sense of public education. Mm-hmm. I think that's a part of this discussion that, for me at least, has been, I've seen it change, and you can talk about how it's worse than it used to be or whatever the case may be, but I see the assault on public education as a really important piece of this puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And it bothers me greatly. It's very fearful to me. Because I see it being, public education is where the people who can't afford something else will end up.
Well, a host of good issues that you're getting on the table. And I would say seek me out through the week, and we'll at least try to touch base with some of the kinds of concerns that you've raised, and where we all go with this week, in part will depend on some of your interests and concerns. Hope to see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.